Greetings once again from Denver, Colorado, the city right here in the middle of it all. You may have heard the news. But stand by now for the worldview. Welcome back to the Weekly Worldview. This is the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. So glad to have you here on Independence Day. It's the 4th of July, and we are going out worldwide to a worldwide audience unconstrained by the traditional bounds of the broadcast media. We welcome you aboard this Independence Day. That's right. And do you realize, I was just skimming the news headlines. Do you realize that the Afghan war is now the longest war in the history of our republic since the American War for Independence? That's right. Over 8 years now in Afghanistan. Yeah, the American War for Independence. I prefer that to the title of Revolutionary War. Because as a conservative, you know, I know that revolutions are a bad thing. I mean, when I think of a revolution, I think of the French Revolution and the guillotines and all that. And what is it now? The 8th Republic, the 12th Republic? I forget what's happening in France right now, but it hasn't ended well. So I prefer the term the American War for Independence, which occurred, well, starting back in 1776, and lasting not quite as long as our current foray into Afghanistan. But I think the term Revolutionary War caught on mostly just as a semantic thing, because Revolutionary War rolls off the tongue so much more easily than the American War for Independence. But a war for independence it was, and the American founders were anything but revolutionaries. They were somewhat conservative in their thinking. But let's not get into that. It's the 4th of July. We're getting ready. We're geared up here at the McBurney compound with lots of legal fireworks. All legal, which in Colorado means lame. Lame fireworks that don't leave the ground. They don't even sell firecrackers here. You can't get a black cat here. No firecrackers, no bottle rockets, nothing that leaves the ground. Fortunately, our children are still young enough that they're very easily impressed. So it doesn't take much. Otherwise, the restrictions here in Colorado on fireworks would certainly dampen their spirits here on Independence Day. But move on we shall, as the children are now just lounging about the house, anticipating nightfall, just waiting for nightfall. That's all they're looking forward to, as am I. But happy 4th of July, ladies and gentlemen. Let's go to Caracas, Venezuela, to see how does our republic stand. What is the state of the union, so to speak? Down in Caracas, Venezuela, the government there has seized control of 11 oil rigs owned by a U.S. drilling company, Helmerich & Payne. Now, Helmerich & Payne, the drilling company, shut the rigs down because the state-owned oil company there in Venezuela was behind on payments. Now, they've been working these rigs for the Venezuelan government for a number of years. And, well, as of June 14th, Helmerich & Payne claim they were owed $43 million, and they've had the rig shut down for about a year, just saying they want to be paid for work that they've already done. Well, Oil Minister Rafael Ramirez, not to be confused with the Atlanta Braves shortstop from the 1980s, this is the oil minister from Venezuela, Rafael Ramirez, says that Helmerich & Payne have rejected Venezuelan government demands to resume drilling operations for more than a year. And, well, that's because they haven't been paid. But in the socialist utopia of Venezuela, the oil minister is wondering, why does that have anything to do with anything? What do you mean we don't have to pay you? We'll just seize your rigs. How about that? And so the Venezuelan government has seized the private assets, the private property of American citizens on the 4th of July. And what is the United States government going to do about it? Are they going to defend the property rights of our citizens against this tin pot dictator down there? Well, I have a quote here from a U.S. State Department spokesman. And the spokesman from the State Department says, "We would just call on the Venezuelans, you know, if they did make such a move to nationalize, that they would compensate the owner of those wells." That's this State Department position. I hope I haven't offended anyone. "Mr. Chavez, are you okay with that?" says the State Department. By the way, just a note to the State Department. The Venezuelans didn't take the wells. They took the rigs, you morons. See, the State Department doesn't even understand the equation. I'm sure the wells were already Venezuela's. Helmrich and Payne were running the rigs, drilling the wells. They own the equipment that's drilling the hole in the ground. The hole in the ground is the well, you hole-in-the-ground moron there at the State Department. They didn't nationalize the wells. They stole their stuff. They stole their property. On the 4th of July, right in your face, to the Obama administration. And what are they going to do about it? They're not going to do anything about it. They're just going to hope that Helmrich and Payne are compensated in some way. You know, maybe some coffee or something. I don't know. It's just sad on the 4th of July to see private property seized by a communist dictator in Venezuela. And the mightiest nation on earth is seemingly helpless to do anything about it. It's just embarrassing. Further embarrassment from the current powers that be. Nancy Pelosi has spoken and lent her wisdom to the topic of unemployment checks. She says that unemployment checks, quote, "inject demand into the economy, and they create jobs faster than almost any other initiative you can name," unquote. That's Nancy Pelosi coming to the epiphany that unemployment checks create jobs. Well, certainly, it's probably been more effective than the stimulus money that was stolen from our grandchildren and is currently being squandered on, well, things like unemployment checks, and soon to be squandered primarily on the 2010 elections, in my humble opinion. Pelosi says that unemployment checks have a double benefit, she says, of helping those who lost their jobs and acting as a job creator on the side. A job creator, Nancy, indeed. Okay, take another Xanax, go get some more Botox, and just get out, Nancy. You're embarrassing. Is she up for election this year? I suppose it doesn't matter because I think Nancy's is automatic. But I believe she's up for election. For those of you out there in California, you may just want to look twice at the ballot this year. And if there's anyone or anything on the ballot that you could choose besides Nancy Pelosi, well, you might want to check that box just to save yourself from further embarrassment, if nothing else. It's just depressing here on the 4th of July. Independence Day, as we celebrate, how many years would this be now? 236, is that right? 1776, 86, 96, oh, it's 234 years. I went to public school. I can barely do math in my head. All right, now let's move on to some encouraging news from the Real Science File here at the Weekly Worldview. There's a new vehicle called the Transition. And it has been created by a company called Terrafugia. Terrafugia, I said. Now, this is a vehicle that is classified as a light sport aircraft. Yeah, and the FAA has granted the Terrafugia Transition, that's the name of the vehicle, they've granted the Terrafugia Transition an exemption so that it can be classified as a light sport aircraft, even though it's 120 pounds over the limit. Now, this is a vehicle that you can fly, and then when you land, you can fold up the wings, drive off the airport onto a road, and drive home. This is what I've been waiting for about 20 years. I've been wondering, where's my flying car? Well, here it is, and the FAA has decided to classify it as a light sport aircraft, which means Terrafugia can actually move into production now. They have a prototype, it looks a little goofy. I mean, it doesn't look like the Jetsons, you know, doesn't look like that. It's got a propeller on the back, and it's got some big wings that you've got to lock down into position in order to take off. The good news is that to get a license for this vehicle only requires about 20 hours of flying time. So it's a lot easier to obtain a license for a light sport aircraft than for a typical airplane. It's a two-seater plane, uses front-wheel drive on the roads at ordinary highway speeds, 60 to 75 miles an hour with the wings folded, gets 30 miles to the gallon, and once you arrive at a suitable takeoff spot, according to the Telegraph out of London, you can fold down the wings, engage its rear-facing propeller, and take off. That's great. Man, that's so awesome. Its cruising speed in the air is 115 miles an hour. It has a range of 460 miles and can carry 450 pounds. It requires just a third of a mile runway to take off, and it will fit in a standard garage, which means you could land at the airport, forget security, drive home, and park it in your garage. How do I get one? I want one. Let's see. 70 people have ordered the car. They've put down their $10,000 deposit. The car is expected to retail at just under $200,000. $200,000. Can we fit that? Can we work that into next year's McBurney budget? The McBurney household budget? We could probably scrape together the 10 grand to put a down payment on it, but let's see. A payment on a $194,000 plane would be roughly, I mean, that's a couple grand a month.
How many years?
A couple grand a month for, well, 30 years. you have to, let's see. Well, if it's a five, yeah, it's about, yeah. We may not be able to work that into this upcoming fiscal year, but we want to put that on the agenda. That's all. I want to put that on the agenda. And so some encouraging news. All is not lost. I've always wondered who dropped the ball on the flying car. And apparently this vehicle was designed by a bunch of MIT engineers. So maybe the flying car was just a lot more difficult than you or I thought. Anyway, that goes into the budget planning for next year. See, I wish I was like Nancy Pelosi, and I could just assume, I could just borrow the money from China. Maybe we could, dear, perhaps we could issue some bonds and offer them for sale to the Chinese to fund our effort to purchase a Terrafugia transition. Very cool. All right. So there's your encouraging news for the week. It's all downhill from here. Well, let's move into the culture file. From San Francisco, the Associated Press, one person is dead after a shooting in a San Francisco gay pride street party. Now, if everyone's so darn gay at the street party, why has someone been shot and killed? Perhaps they're gay, but they're not all that happy. 19-year-old Stephen Powell is dead, shot to death in the street amongst a crowd of allegedly gay people. He was one of three people shot last Saturday night during the city's Pink Saturday celebrations there in San Francisco. Not surprising. It's the 40th annual Gay Pride Weekend. 40 years, ladies and gentlemen. The culture here in America, we the people, have tolerated deviant behavior in the streets. In the streets, for crying out loud. Now, you know, I'm not for kicking in anyone's door and asking questions about what they do in private. I'm not for that. But when you've got people marching down the street in various states of undress, shaking their fist at everything that is good and clean and not disgusting, and shaking their fist at God, for that matter, well, I draw the line there. I mean, if you want to destroy your own life, I suppose there's not all that much I can do about it. And if you want to injure the lives of the people in your circle of friends by engaging in deviant, destructive behavior, I suppose if they're willing to tolerate it, there's not a whole lot I can do. But when you want to walk around in public and declare your deviancy as something good, so that I have to, you know, if if my 8-year-old happens to catch the news with me, I just can't imagine. Daddy, what's Gay Pride Pink Streets Week? I just don't want to answer that question. So, anyway. So, and now we have someone shot and killed. And they don't know who did it, but we're assuming it was someone who was not gay. At least in the happy sense. It may have been a fellow homosexual. We will not follow this story to get you an update. You'll have to look for it on your own. All right. More from San Francisco. From the Associated Press. Should we move on? Okay, so from homosexuals being shot and killed in the streets in San Francisco, we go to the NAACP there, and the California chapter has pledged its support for a marijuana legalization ballot measure. Yeah, the NAACP California chapter highlighted findings it says shows the arrest rate among blacks for low-level marijuana crimes far exceed those of whites. So, I don't understand this. Because black people are more likely to be arrested for possessing dope, let's legalize dope. Well, what if black people are more likely to be arrested for robbery, or armed robbery, or murder? Should we legalize those? I mean, that's the logic if I follow it, and I'm not sure that I do. The NAACP's announcement has outraged a Sacramento preacher who is leading opposition to the legalization of dope in California. International Faith-Based Coalition President Ron Allen said African-American leaders are distressed that one of the country's most respected civil rights organizations would disregard the harm caused by illicit drugs amongst black people. He says, quote, the NAACP does not represent the African-American community when it comes to legalizing marijuana. Well, and I certainly agree with Mr. Allen there. The NAACP doesn't represent anything sane anymore. They're completely gone. They're too far gone, the NAACP. I mean, the NAACP will come out for legalizing black-on-black crime since blacks are more likely to be arrested for it. Out of the streets of San Francisco, we'll go down to Texas, where one would think that things are a little more sane. Should we go to Texas, or should we stay in stay in California? Well, let's stay in California briefly before we get to Texas. Down in Los Angeles, according to the Associated Press, police are investigating a third Los Angeles medical marijuana dispensary shooting. Another shooting. That's right, an employee at a San Fernando Valley dispensary was shot in the face and critically wounded during a robbery last Saturday night. The gunman escaped with $11,000 there at the home of Peace and Love, the marijuana dispensary, your local medical marijuana dispensary. Police Captain Kevin McClure there in Los Angeles says there doesn't appear to be any connection between these shootings and this shooting and the two shootings that occurred the previous week. He says there's no apparent connection, but he says this does represent a disturbing pattern. That's right. A disturbing but not altogether surprising pattern of shootings and robberies at medical marijuana dispensaries. Not all that surprising. Let's see here. Oh, they're shutting down. What our government here in Colorado has decided to do is to jack up the regulatory paperwork to a point where the average pothead just can't deal with it. And so they figure half the marijuana dispensaries in Colorado will be shut down in the coming year because the stoners just can't. I mean, they're looking at the paperwork like, dude, there's so much to dude, look at this. This is like 14 pages, man. They're asking for like bank account statements and dude. So we should see a decrease in the medical marijuana dispensaries here in Colorado in the coming year. But basically, the government, in regulating them, has, for all intents and purposes, legitimized them for all time. I mean, there's no going back. Marijuana is now legal in Colorado. And there you have it, okay? For whatever that's worth, I think it's bad. That's all. Well, let's go on here, and here's why it's bad, okay? Because marijuana, just like alcohol, makes you do stupid things. Now, why is alcohol legal, or why do I think alcohol should be legal and marijuana not? Well, you can drink alcohol and not do stupid things. You can drink alcohol and not get drunk. But whenever you smoke marijuana, it's to become intoxicated. And so anything with the express purpose of intoxicating the user should, by definition, be illegal because it's destructive. Intoxication is a destructive state that tears the fiber of a family and eventually a nation asunder. And so it's a crime. Just like homosexuality. Just like adultery. Adultery is a crime that should be punished for the same reason. Homosexuality is a crime for the same reason that intoxicants are a crime. Because they tear at the family. Anything that leads to the destruction of the family is a crime and should be illegal and punished by law. And in fact, I would say, before we outlaw homosexuality or drugs, we should outlaw adultery. Because it is the primary destroyer of the family. It is, of the three, it is the most destructive, in my opinion. I give equal opportunity to all crimes when I call for their prohibition. Yeah, just so you know. All right, now, an example of why pot should not be legal. This is from thesmokinggun.com. The parents of a 13-month-old Texas boy are facing felony endangerment charges after the child's father allegedly put a marijuana bong on the toddler's lips. The bong was seized by the cops last Monday after they received a tip that Julio Garcia was smoking marijuana in the Grapevine, Texas apartment he shares with Brenda Duran, the boy's 19-year-old mother. Why is this written that way? He shares the apartment with the boy's mother. He's the father. Is that unusual anymore that mothers and fathers actually share the same domicile? I don't know. Anyway, that just threw me. I'm not sure why it's worded that way. I just don't get it. But that's beside the point. Let's get back to the point. Julio was charged with child endangerment and marijuana possession. The mother was hit with an endangerment charge since she was present in the bedroom where her child handled the bong. The boy was placed in the custody of relatives who may or may not have a bong at their house. Who knows? Anyway, the parents were arrested. And, you know, how old was this? If your 13-month-old is ill, it's not unusual to give the child a sip of wine, and it's not considered immoral. Help the child sleep, maybe calm the stomach down, a little wine, right? There's alcohol in a lot of the medicines that you give your children. Okay, but nowhere do you put a bong to the kid's lips when the child is sick. It's just immoral. And everybody knows it instinctively. And so there, that helps me to illustrate the point that I was trying to make earlier. All right, now let's move on. From the Silicon Valley, Google, which you know is a company that's famous for offering its employees great benefits, what they've decided now is that they will now adjust paychecks for their gay and lesbian employees. So that means if you're happy, or if you have relatives who descended from the Isle of Lesbos there off Greece, No, that's not what it means. Google will now adjust paychecks for their homosexual employees who opt for domestic partner benefits to cover a tax that those benefits have had to those beneficiaries have had to pay. Google offers benefits to the spouses or partners of both straight and gay employees. However, the married straight employees don't get taxed on those extra benefits, but the homosexuals do, because that's the federal law for some reason. It's just bizarre. The government has said, look, homosexuals are equal. They deserve equal rights, not special rights, and then they treat them unequally. So, see, it's an example of how you can't have it both ways. Homosexuality is either a crime or it's normal. It's either deviant or it's constructive. It's one of the, you can't have it both ways, and the government, being a bunch of hypocrites, act like hypocrites in the laws they pass regulating deviant behavior. It's just embarrassing. How about this? Homosexuality should be against the law, right after adultery. Adultery first, and then we'll get to the homos. Let's address the normal people first and the problems we have there, which dwarf the homosexual problem, frankly. But let's address that first, and then let's just make all this deviant sexual behavior against the law, and then you don't have to have hypocritical, ignorant, stupid regulations so that the freaks at Google can go out and self-aggrandize themselves and what great humanitarians they are in allowing their homosexual employees to get a tax break or whatever. It's just disgusting. The pay raise to the homosexuals will be retroactive to the beginning of 2010. Heterosexual employees with long-term partners, otherwise known in the common parlance as shacking up, won't see the pay adjustment because they could marry and therefore get the tax break if they wish. You see what happens when you start accepting all this deviant behavior as normal? Things get so confusing that you can't even read through a news story without even not even knowing where you are anymore. I'm reading this, I'm like, what's going on? They'll get the tax, they won't get the tax because they could marry, but they don't, and they wouldn't, but it was a sheep and not a dog, and I just don't understand it anymore. Let's move on to something we can all relate to. Bed bugs. That's right. Abercrombie and Fitch and a Hollister store there in the Village in New York City have been closed due to a bed bug infestation. I said bed bugs, yeah. They were closed last Wednesday. One on Wednesday, one on Friday. The company says they intend to reopen the stores as soon as possible, as soon as they get rid of all these bed bugs. So here's the deal with bed bugs. So on my travels, I encountered some bed bugs, okay, because I travel, and I encountered some bed bugs, and I mentioned it casually to some friends of mine, and within 20 minutes of me mentioning to one friend, word spread like wildfire. Another friend of mine called me on the phone. They were like, Doug, did you say bed bugs? Doug, this is serious. Tell us what happened. Are you okay? Do you have a plan? I was like, what? It's bed bugs. I threw my clothes out in the garage. I'll let them sit there for a couple days. No, Doug. You don't understand. People go bankrupt trying to get rid of bed bugs. People go insane. They end up jumping out a fifth floor window because of bed bugs. You don't understand. Well, needless to say, the little critters did follow me. And I have had to, we finally isolated the infestation. Now, the McBurney compound was not infested, okay? I want to make that clear. The McBurney compound was never compromised by the bed bugs. But one leather jacket that I do own apparently did acquire some level of infestation. So I wasn't sure what to do. I didn't know. Well, my extremely attractive audio engineer, in her brilliance, she said, let's take the jacket, let's put it in a black plastic bag, let's put it out on the deck and let it sit in the sun. Because she learned that if you raise the temperature of the bedbug environment to 140 degrees Fahrenheit for any significant period of time, not only will the bedbugs die, but their eggs will die, everything will die. You will basically stop any biological regeneration within that leather jacket. So we put it out there, and I tested the temperature. The temperature on the outside of the bag yesterday was 140-some-odd degrees. And the bag was melting on itself. So I said, I think we've done it. She said, leave it there for a few more days. So anyway, Yeah, so the bed bugs are on the comeback. There's a lot of debate about why bed bugs are coming back. You know, some people say it's because we stopped using DDT. And apparently that's not the case because a number of the bed bugs around now have developed a resistance to DDT. And so even if we did use DDT, the bed bugs might be coming back. And I think the likely explanation, because bed bugs were virtually eradicated in the 1950s and 60s, here in the United States anyways, I think it's international travel. And going in and out of the third world, we're bringing back these resistant bed bugs. And, well, there you go. You end up with bed bugs at the gates. All right. Now, if that didn't disgust you, listen to this. From Atlanta, Georgia, the Associated Press, U.S. Airways says maggots falling from an overhead bin from a container of spoiled meat forced a plane to return to the gate there in Atlanta. A passenger apparently brought the container onto the plane, that is, a container of spoiled meat, onto the plane, and passengers noticed maggots falling from the overhead bin last Monday on a flight bound for North Carolina. Well, no, they say a passenger brought the rotten meat onto that specific flight. That's what U.S. Airways says. Now, the plane returned to the gate. Passengers got off so crews could clean the overhead bin. And then the passengers were told to get back on that plane. And the flight then continued on to Charlotte. I don't know if I could get back on a plane after maggots had fallen out of the overhead. I'm sorry. And I'm not a germaphobe type or anything, but maggots? Anyway, the plane was then taken out of service and fumigated. And so there you have it. So what is it that could be responsible for maggots on a plane? I mean, I don't know. I would say, again, it's probably somehow related to the third world. Sometimes you care. Sometimes you get care. Sometimes you care. Sometimes you get care. Yeah. Oh, oh, oh. Ah, ah, ah. Speaking of deviants, we want to thank the members of NXS for providing a little bumper music. How is it that guy died? Wasn't it him and like the guy from Kung Fu had a similar fate there? Anyway, let's not get into all that. Now that should be illegal. All right, let's go to back down to Texas. Let's see. So we're gonna go to the justice file. It's a good news, bad news justice file this week. And the good news is there's some good news in the justice file this week. I mean, usually it's just a bad news, worse news. A story from the justice file. But this week we start in Huntsville, Texas. That's right. Convicted killer Michael James Perry was executed last Thursday evening. Praise the Lord. He had some last words, did Michael James Perry. Now, let me see. Now, just so you know about Michael James Perry, before we read his last words, let me tell you a little bit about Michael James Perry. Perry was convicted of shooting Sandra Stotler twice in the back at her home and stealing her Camaro back in 2001. Perry and a friend, Jason Burkett, then dumped her body in a lake and returned to her Lake Conroe subdivision to wait for her son. Perry and Burkett lured the son, Adam Stotler, just 16 years old, and his friend Jeremy Richardson to a nearby wooded area, shot them dead, and stole Adam Stotler's vehicle as well. So, a triple murderer here. Michael James Perry, convicted. His last words before his execution, he said, quote, "I want to start off to everyone involved in this atrocity. They are all forgiven by me," said the triple murderer. So the triple murderer was forgiving his executioners. Then he lifted his head from the pillow and his voice was cracking and he cried out, "Mom, I love you." I'm coming home, Dad. I'm coming home, he added. His father, according to the Associated Press, died last month and apparently is already in hell. Because the lad said, I'm coming home, Dad. Now, we don't know if his dad's in hell, but we certainly know that Michael James Perry is currently dwelling in the nether regions. That's right. During the execution, Michael James Perry never acknowledged the relatives of his victims who were in attendance. So he's definitely in hell. Let's see. Michael James Perry was only the 14th prisoner executed this year in Texas, and Texas leads the nation. And that's just sad. How many murders are there every year? 15,000 murders? Of those, let's say half of them get solved. That's 7,500. So how many executions should there be? Well, there should be at least a little over 7,000 executions in the coming year. And then the following year, you would be amazed at the drop in the murder rate. It would be amazing. It would be a wonderful sociological experiment to conduct. And I'd like to volunteer to head that experiment. All right, so good news out of Texas, but it's not all good news. Let's go on to Dallas. Again from the AP. A San Antonio woman who told authorities the devil made her mutilate and dismember her newborn baby was found not guilty by reason of insanity last Thursday. In a deal she made with prosecutors that sends her to a state mental institution rather than face a trial and a possible prison sentence. So, Adi Sanchez, the mother, if you can call her that, has made a plea agreement with the prosecutors to save them some time and some paperwork. And the plea agreement was accepted last week. She made it with prosecutors. The baby, Scotty Sanchez, I don't even know if I want to read this, frankly. Scotty was 3 weeks old when authorities received a 911 call from the boy's aunt, and they arrived to find his mutilated body and the mother wailing that the devil made her do it.
Well,
and abortionists do the same thing, but they don't say the devil made them do it. They actually take a check. No, cash. Well, I think they'll take a check. This woman, Adi Sanchez, she will be committed until the court decides, committed to a mental institution, until the court decides she is not a danger to herself or anyone else. As if anyone could make that assessment. I mean, she's mutilated and murdered a three-week-old baby. I don't think you get a strike two. I don't think. I mean, does anybody think? Apparently somebody thinks. Apparently the culture thinks that you can mutilate, brutalize, and murder a three-week-old baby and then get a second chance. I just don't get it. The story goes on, by the way, if you wonder why our culture is brainwashed to believe that we have to tolerate murderers. Well, the AP goes on in the story to say an estimated 1,000 women are afflicted with postpartum psychosis every year. Postpartum psychosis, which they delineate from postpartum depression, which just makes you depressed. They say half of all women experience that. But 1,000 are afflicted with postpartum psychosis, which causes you to just go crazy after you have a baby. And then the story goes on. Andrea Yates, the suburban Houston mother who drowned her 5 children in a bathtub in 2001, and Dina Schlosser, who cut off her baby's arms in 2004, both suffered. Now, these are the women who killed their kids or mutilated and cut off their arms. They suffered from the psychosis. Well, they didn't suffer as much as the child whose arms were cut off. They didn't suffer as much as the children who were drowned in the lake. But the AP wants us to know that they suffered. They suffered. These poor victims, they're victims of postpartum psychosis. They suffered. The attorney for Adi Sanchez, who mutilated and killed her three-week-old baby, her attorney says, quote, the justice system has come a long way since Yate was convicted and faced a possible death sentence back in 2002. So is that where the lawyers want to take us? They say that society has come a long way, because Adi Sanchez is going to go to a mental hospital after murdering her child, and she'll probably be released at some point in the future. Is that where the lawyers want to take us? That must be where the old saying comes from. First, kill all the lawyers, right? Remember I said first make adultery a crime, then homosexuality, then a drug. Actually, move each one of those down one notch. And first, kill all the lawyers. All right. And I say that figuratively, obviously. I don't mean that literally. Now, if that justice news didn't turn your stomach, well, you're probably not human. But let's move on to New York City, where one would expect this type of insanity. The second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Manhattan overturned the death sentence given to Ronell Wilson after concluding that prosecutors made legal errors during the penalty phase of the trial, and these legal errors were not corrected by the judge in his instruction to the jurors, and there was some other paperwork, and an I wasn't dotted, a T wasn't crossed. There were certain items and elements that simply didn't line up with the proper jurisprudence and this and that and schlemmin' a hagin' a hammin' a hand. And anyway, the guy killed two cops, but, you know, we can't execute him. That's the bottom line, right? The appeals court upheld the conviction of Wilson in the March 10th, 2003 robbery and murder of detectives James Nemorin and Rodney Andrews on Staten Island. I said a robbery and murder of two detectives. But there were some instructions that may have not been communicated properly during the course of the trial, and they weren't corrected, and basically, we can't execute this guy. Now, he may get, there may be another opportunity. There will be another hearing as to whether or not he gets the death penalty, and there will be new aggravating and mitigating factors introduced so that the jury can be bamboozled into allowing this piece of offal to remain alive amongst us for, well, until he dies a natural death, I'm sure. Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly there in New York says that he, quote, believes that the murder of a police officer is an attack on society itself and should be punished with the death penalty, unquote. Now, I agree with Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly that murder of a police officer is an attack on society itself and should be punished with the death penalty. But Commissioner Kelly, how is it that the murder of any one of our citizens is not an attack on society itself? I mean, who was it who said if you save one life, you've saved the whole world? Was it Martin Luther King Jr.? Was he quoting someone else? Anyway, it's a true statement. And also true is that if you attack and brutalize and murder one person, I don't care if they're a plumber or a lawyer or a police officer or a housewife or a child, you have attacked and brutalized, and it's as if you have murdered the entire civilization. And that's why you cannot be tolerated amongst the living, and you must be put to death. I mean, can't we all agree on some certain fundamentals, or can we not anymore? Perhaps that's the problem, is that we just don't agree anymore. And the suicidal amongst us seem to have won the day. They seem to have won the argument. And they want those of us who are not suicidal to tolerate murderers. And I'm just wondering, when is it that the sane amongst us in the civilization come to the point where we draw the line and we say this far and no further? I mean, we have detectives murdered, we have children dismembered, drowned, brutalized, and murdered, and yet not a single politician stands up and says, it's time to draw the line this far and no further. Thank you. Did you catch that at the end? Where he's taking a drag on the cigarette. So allegedly, he did that to annoy his high school music teacher, who said that he wasn't really like a talented musician because he was a rock guitar player. So he recorded that, and then took a puff off the stogie at the end, just for his school teacher. Anyway, I'm just trying to cheer myself up after a disturbing string of justice news, and you wonder why is it that there isn't a politician in the country who could galvanize the people around the idea that we simply can no longer tolerate the level of violence and bloodshed in our culture. Well, let me give you an example of why. It's because the politicians are incredibly stupid and confused. In Chicago, Illinois, the aldermen there at the student council in Chicago have voted 45-0 last Friday to approve a rushed-through compromise gun ban after the U.S. Supreme Court, you'll remember, struck down the old Chicago gun ban. So the student council bumbling idiots there in Chicago, which last I checked was a bastion of peace, love, and brotherhood, have decided that they simply have to ban guns. The new law allows adults in Chicago to buy one gun a month, but they must pay a registration and permit fee and take 5 hours of training. Also, within 100 days, anyone who wants to keep a gun in the city will have to register, get their training, and pay the fees. And within 100 days, any of the estimated 10,000 Chicagoans convicted of a gun offense will have to register at their local police station like sex offenders. So here we have this is where our latest president came out of, right? I mean, this should be a pretty good example of where we are politically here in America. And we've got ignorant, foolish student council members rushing through gun bans while the blood in their city runs up to the policeman's belt on any given weekend evening in the south side of Chicago. Let's see here. The police superintendent there says that Chicago's gun ban was the nation's strictest. And, he or she, whoever, says a bunch of other just worthless, I mean, just unbelievable. I mean, you'd think the police would know. Anyway, I guess we see how the most strict gun ban was working there in Chicago, with an average of, I think, 10 to 12 people murdered every weekend during the summer. You know, sometimes as high as 20 people getting shot in one night. So that was under the old rules, which the Supreme Court struck down. So we see how well they were working, and now we'll see how well the new ones work. They'll have no effect, ladies and gentlemen. Because I don't have to explain why. If I have to explain why, you're an idiot, and you shouldn't even be listening to this show. You're not qualified to listen to the show if I have to explain that. You should turn it off right now and unsubscribe. All right. Let's move on into the war file because we're running out of time. From Washington, the announcement that 10 alleged long-term deep-cover Russian spies have been arrested on American soil apparently was no surprise to one Russian defector, Sergei Tretiakov. Sergei Tretiakov. He says, Cold War never ended. It's like virus. You apply the medicine and virus develops a resistance and it continues. Yeah, that's what he says. And he should know. He defected with a whole bunch of secrets, actual secrets that he brought here. He said during the Cold War, the Soviet Union identified the U.S. as a potential enemy. And he says potential meant the attack may come in 10 days to 100 years. It may never happen. It's just a potential enemy. He says, but now, he says, Russia has reclassified the U.S. as a, quote, main target, unquote. And he says that's much different than a potential enemy. And he says the risk to us is even greater. Well, I suppose if the Russians had the wherewithal to actually do anything, I suppose it would be. Well, of course, they are in league with the Iranians and the radical fundamentalist Islamists, who could definitely smuggle some type of horrible device somewhere and blow it up. So it is of some concern. I mean, the Russians are still bad. I don't trust the Russians. He says that leadership in Russia is still smarting over the perception that the Soviets lost the Cold War. He says they are committed to restoring Russian honor. And that should not be discounted. Anyway, what's the point of the story? We got a deep undercover spy ring. What I found a little funny and amusing is that they say this ring's been spying on us for 10 years, and that the our government has been following them for 10 years and finally busted them. And I'm wondering, what, you know, you pretty much knew they were here from day one, and you've just been waiting for the right moment. And why was now the right moment? Why wasn't, say, 8.5 years ago the right moment? I don't know. But maybe this explains all those Russian moms down in the park. When I go down the park with my kids, half the people there are speaking Russian. The other half are speaking Spanish. That I understand. But the Russian thing has always thrown me for a loop. Now, perhaps, there's some explanation to it all. All right, let's move on into the war file from Somalia. Somali President Sheikh Sharif Sheikh Ahmed joined his troops on the front line last Wednesday to fight hardline anti-government Islamists. And when I first read that first line, I was like, all right, he's out there on the front line. He's got an AK-47. Here's what one of his aides said. The president is on the front line leading the fight against Al-Shabaab, and he is armed with an AK-47. Now that sounds like a president to me, and I was somewhat uplifted by the thought of a president grabbing a rifle and leading troops into battle against Al-Shabaab, which is basically Al-Qaeda in Somalia. The police chief in Somalia says that the drive led by the president marks the beginning of a larger operation against Al-Shabaab. But this is where the story gets a little less, I get a little less enthusiastic. Before he became president, this current AK-wielding Sheikh Sharif Sheikh Ahmed, before he became president in 2009, he led an Islamist movement that took control of the capital in 2006. And then he became president of an unbacked unity government there in Somalia. So it turns out it's just one group of Islamists against another. So there's the one group of Islamists that has seduced the UN and all of the UN's subordinate organizations into believing that we can do business with this particular Islamist against the far more radical Al-Shabaab. I because they're related to Al-Qaeda. I mean, to me, one Islamist is as good dead as the other, frankly. And I don't think we can work with any of them. It'd be nice if we could find... But you probably can't find a Christian willing to pick up an AK-47 and take over this dump. You probably just can't. Christians have been so cowed and feminized and they're just so peaceful. You got one Islamist against a supposedly worst Islam. I guess you have a good Islamist against a bad Islamist. This just can't end well. Anyway, but my, how it would be wonderful to think of, you know, it would be great if when Obama had fired McChrystal, if he had grabbed an M16 and landed in Afghanistan in the Swat Valley in Helmand Province, stepped up in front of a brigade and said, "Let's go, boys." That would have been awesome. Not going to happen. All right, into the politics file. Chelsea Clinton plans to marry her fiancé, Mark Mezvinsky, at an upstate New York mansion that is unnamed. She plans to get married on July 31st. Yeah. Chelsea is the daughter of former President Bill Clinton. According to the AP, this is all alleged. I'm just reporting what the AP says. Chelsea is the daughter of former President Bill Clinton and Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton. Mezvinsky, the fiancé, is an investment banker in New York City. That's right. And to the dismay of Hillary, he's a man. Hillary's wondering, where did I go wrong with you, Chelsea? You were supposed to marry someone, a tennis player from Wimbledon, in a skirt. Can you even imagine the level? Okay, let's imagine the Chelsea Clinton wedding, the reception, okay? You sneak your way in. Can you just imagine the level of political correct phoniness that's going to be on display at this wedding? I mean, people who run the world, who rob old women and kill babies, all drinking champagne and telling each other how fabulous you look, my darling. You simply look fabulous. My goodness. The dress is fabulous. Outstanding. What a lovely day. What a beautiful wedding. The cake was fabulous. Now, what are the odds, you think, that Hillary Clinton, or Hillary, we already know Hillary. What are the odds that Chelsea could ever recover from her upbringing? Ever. I mean, I think that's why God is so merciful. Because he realizes that some children are brought up in such a distorted and twisted upbringing that they simply have no chance to ever break free from the corruption in which they've been raised. I mean, you think about someone who's raised, let's say, in Somalia, where their whole family is Islamic radicals worshiping Allah, praying for the death of Israel and the blood of the Jews. And how is this kid ever gonna come to a knowledge of the Creator and the living God of the universe and his mercy and his justice? How is that ever going to happen? Well, that's why I think God hasn't destroyed the world. He's just trying to give all these poor people, like that little kid in a hovel in Somalia, and Chelsea Clinton in the mansion in upstate New York, he's trying to give them all as much time as possible to come to some realization that their parents are evil and they lied and that they need to seek God. So anyway, that's my all-encompassing theory for the week. All right, let's move on now quickly. We are running out of time. I am going to go just a little bit long because I don't want to leave any of these stories out because it is the 4th of July. From ABC News in Washington State, from Portland, it's all the same to me up there, you know, where it's green and it rains all the time. Portland, Seattle, whatever. Police have reopened an investigation into a claim by a Portland masseuse that former Vice President Al Gore made unwanted contact with her in a hotel room. And folks, I give no credence to this story. This woman, she didn't cry out there at the when it happened. She didn't freak out and call the police. I think she's a liar. I don't buy any of this. Or at least I didn't, okay? Until Mr. Gore's lawyer came out. I was so ready to give Al Gore the benefit of the doubt here. But his lawyer has come out with a statement. Mr. Gore unequivocally and emphatically denies this accusation. And I'm thinking to myself, why did you need unequivocally and emphatically? Couldn't you just say, Mr. Gore denies this allegation? But no. Mr. Gore now is unequivocally and emphatically denying it, which leads me to believe it's probably true. And that's just sad. But I could care less. I mean, you got some gold digger in a motel room with some bloated pervert. I mean, what do you expect's going to happen for crying out loud? I mean, should any of us be surprised? Actually, I am surprised. I thought Al Gore was all about idealism and money. And it turns out that, he learned a little bit more from Bubba Bill Jeff than I might have thought. By golly. All right, into the war file. North Korea. Serious news. North Korea. So you'll remember, sank a South Korean warship and is now calling for a new joint investigation by both Koreas. And this has nothing to do with medical marijuana. They don't want to get together with South Korean officials, smoke a joint, and then try to figure out who sunk that ship. They want a joint investigation by both Koreas to, quote, verify the truth of the incident. Yes, North Korea is calling for a new investigation alongside South Korean officials, where no one is under the influence of marijuana, and they investigate who sunk that South Korean ship. Maybe we'll find out that it was Somali pirates there off the coast of South Korea, perhaps. North Korea's unambassador, Shin Sun-ho, I didn't make up his name. That's the unambassador for North Korea, Shin Sun-ho. Golly. That's so shallow of me to make fun of. Shin Sun-ho has called for a high-level military talks between the two Koreas Sin urged the council to take measures to help realize these talks before it deals with the results of the internal investigation led by South Korea. You'll remember that. That investigation concluded that the North Koreans torpedoed the South Korean ship, the Chonan, back in March, you remember, killing 46 Korean sailors. An international investigation, it concluded that, the North Koreans, who are technically at war with the South Koreans, torpedoed the ship. Well, the North Koreans claim that investigation is tainted, perhaps because nobody was using any medical marijuana during the investigation, and we just don't know what happens. Perhaps a joint investigation is what we need. South Korea wants the UN Security Council to condemn North Korea, for whatever that's worth. North Korea has warned that its military forces will respond if the UN Security Council questions or condemns the country over the sinking of the Chonan. The ship's sinking, by the way, is a violation of the 1953 armistice agreement that ended the Korean War. So you know that the conflict ended there in Korea, but the war never did. And so what the North Koreans have done now is they have violated the armistice for the umpteenth time and killed 46 South Korean sailors. And what is the world going to do? What are the Western powers going to do? Well, the same thing they're going to do to the Venezuelans for stealing all that oil rig equipment. They're not going to do anything. They're going to condemn it, and they're going to suggest that somebody be compensated. And then they're all going to go out after their meetings there at the United Nations, and they're going to get a bunch of cocaine and hookers together, and they're going to hang out with the North Koreans, because that's what they're all about up there. Quickly, we have a couple stories from the government school file. From Maitland, Florida, the Orlando Sentinel, Liberty Council, an organization there in Maitland, has filed a lawsuit to overturn a ban on Bible distribution on public school campuses in Collier County, Florida. So the Collier County School Board allowed World Changers, that's another organization, the World Changers, to distribute free Bibles to students during off-school hours on Religious Freedom Day. But now the school officials claim that Bibles do not provide any educational benefit to the students, and the distribution of Bibles should stop. Couple things, okay? First of all, the public schools have a Religious Freedom Day. This is America. Every day is supposed to be Religious Freedom Day. I think, right? I can't remember which amendment that was, Religious Freedom. Oh, yeah, the very first one. Freedom of religion. But in the public schools, they have Religious Freedom Day. And on that day, the school board says you can't distribute Bibles. So anyway, if you're still sending your kids to the public school, you're not qualified to listen to this program. You should turn it off and unsubscribe. You are an idiot. Let's see. Now, the Collier County School District, according to the Orlando Sentinel, allows the distribution of literature by nonprofit organizations, but only with the approval of the superintendent and the community request committee. I mean, is this the Soviet Union? You have to have a Religious Freedom Day, and then it has to be approved by the school district, the community request committee, the commissar. It all has to be approved and stamped by our dear leader before we can distribute Bibles. Anyway, the Community Request Committee denied approval to World Changers to distribute Bibles on Religious Freedom Day. And the Christians who send their kids to the public schools are upset. No. They're just, I mean, how stupid can you be? But maybe this will get the attention of some Christians there, and they'll finally realize that... That if you send your kids to the public schools, you're sinning against God and you're sinning against your child. Just get them out. All right. But not all is lost in the public schools. We have some good news from Provincetown, Massachusetts. The superintendent of Massachusetts School District is apologizing to parents for what she calls a misunderstanding over a condom availability policy there
at the government school.
Superintendent Beth said in a letter emailed last week that the district will clarify that elementary school-age students won't be able to get a condom if they request one from a school nurse. Isn't that good news? For any of you who were worried that maybe the public schools weren't a good environment for your daughter, the Cape Cod Times reports that Superintendent Beth sent the email and said she had to revise the wording of the condom policy after it was so badly understood and misrepresented by the media. You see, the policy of condom distribution in your daughter's government school that was set to take effect in the fall appeared to set no minimum age limit for children to receive condoms without parental consent. It seemed to, and that's because it didn't. It appeared to set no minimum age because it didn't. And besides, why? I think the minimum age for distributing condoms should be 99. You shouldn't be able to get a condom. You shouldn't be able to give a condom to a child, okay? At all. But these are the public schools where now the Christians who send their children there are upset because there's no minimum age. So what should we set it at, Mr. Christian Father? Should we set it at 9? Is it okay to give condoms to the boys who want to molest your daughter? Is it okay to give them rubbers? Is it okay to give them condoms at 9? Or let's say maybe 11, Dad. No, maybe 14. How about that, Dad? Would that make you happy? Unbelievable. All right, finally, Jim Campbell, the president and CEO of General Electric's Appliance and Lighting Division, was seated on a stool at the end of the stage in Louisville, Kentucky, and he fell off the stage as Joe Biden was nearing the end of his remarks. You can see the video on this. It's quite compelling. He tipped right off the stage and fell, crashed to the ground. Biden called for a doctor. What did Biden say? Here's what Biden said after a man collapses behind him, perhaps dead. Okay? Here's what Joe Biden says. Ladies and gentlemen, that's a sad note to end this on. Do we have a doctor here? Hey, Joe, when someone collapses behind you and needs a doctor, it's no longer all about you, Joe. This is a sad note to end this on. All Joe can think about is how it affects his speech. Just unbelievable. So there you have it. That's the worldview for this week. Happy Independence Day, America. I'll be back with you next week. And until then, I want to thank KGov Radio and my other brother, Daryl, who makes it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios. I'll be back with you next week. And until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.